Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 469, The Schmitzes, Republican Family Values, being recorded on July 18th of 2004. Quickly, website Spitfire, www.spitfirelist.com, has written long article-length descriptions of the For the Record shows. Usually those are up within a week or two of the airing of the program. And as I've stressed in the past, don't neglect the descriptions because often they have information that was not included in the original broadcast due simply to the limitations of time. Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. Features a search function, features a landmark text, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, available for download for free. Also, sister station WFMU-FM, the heroic WFMU-FM, is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older programs available for download only, also on Real Audio, at a longer URL, linked to both the www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. Now, we're talking about the Schmitz family and their family values. The elder John Schmitz, John G. Schmitz, an arch-reactionary Republican congressman from Southern California, was the focal point of much of the first side of the program, as were some of his unfortunate progeny, Mary Kay Letourneau, a Seattle school teacher who is now in prison, or has been in prison up until recently, for giving birth to two children whom she conceived with one of her sixth grade students, one of them while out on parole. Also, the fact that John Schmitz had an entire second family by his German mistress, and one of the kids had a strangely mutilated penis. Again, that raises more questions than it does provide answers. What we're going to be looking at in this side of the broadcast is the more formidable and, in my opinion, more important of the Schmitz family, namely John P. Schmitz. We're going to review very briefly some information we looked at in side two. This is from an article by Zizka, somebody who posts on the internet under Zizka. It's at www.johnjemerson.com, Republican Family Values, Sex Criminals, and about John P. Schmitz, not, as far as I know, a sex criminal, but a very interesting individual indeed. We read, John G. Schmitz's son, John P. Schmitz, did not share his father's disdain for George Bush, whom he served as deputy counsel from 1984 to 1993. He was involved in Iran-Contra as a deputy to C. Boyden Gray and as an associate of Janet Rehnquist. Schmitz was one of the few Iran-Contra players to refuse to be interviewed by the independent counsel and was highly instrumental, as was Rehnquist, in protecting Bush. By the way, that's the daughter of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Bush was never questioned in connection with Iran-Contra, and a diary he kept was never examined. Walsh's final report read, quote, "The criminal investigation of Bush was regrettably incomplete. Chapter 28, second paragraph." Since then, John P. Schmitz has popped up every once in a while. He seems to have had dealings with Iraq before the Gulf War, and with his present law firm has worked for Enron, Bayer, producer of Cipro, and United Airlines' 9/11 lawsuit. His firm also has a Central Asian office in Tashkent. Schmitz, along with many men of high repute, is a member of the boards of directors of the American Council on Germany and the Atlantic Council of the U.S. So note here the strong connection between John P. Schmitz and the elder George Bush. Note his, that is to say, John P. Schmitz's apparent involvement not only in the Iran-Contra affair when he was deputy to C. Boyden Gray, the presidential and vice presidential counsel, but note also that John P. Schmitz has had some dealings with Iraq before the Gulf War, which strongly suggests his involvement with some aspects of the Iraqgate scandal as well. We're going to be taking a much longer look at John P. Schmitz here, but note also his presence on the board of directors of the American Council on Germany. Briefly, some of the information about the American Council on Germany from the web, and I will post the URL on the description for the program. The American Council on Germany is a private, nonprofit, national organization that was incorporated in New York City in 1952. Its founding leaders were John J. McCloy, Eric M. Warburg, General Lucius D. Clay, and some other people whose names don't ring a bell for me. Among the people who've participated in its American-German Biennial Conference series in the past, Zbigniew Brzezinski, McGeorge Bundy, Richard Cheney, Newt Gingrich, Henry Kissinger, and George Kennan. And among the members of the board of directors of this organization, Richard Burt is actually a vice chairman. He's a Kissinger protege, by the way. And among the directors are Henry Kissinger, Brent Scowcroft, John J. McCloy II, and Marie Warburg, also of the famous German Warburg family. John J. McCloy is one of the key officials, or was, he's dead now, thank God, but the song is over, but the malady lingers on, I guess one could say. John J. McCloy is well known to veteran listeners to the program. He was deeply involved with the Chase Manhattan Bank, helped to set up the Black Eagle Trust that we spoke about in connection with the remarkable book by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, Gold Warriors. John J. McCloy was U.S. High Commissioner to Germany. As such, was responsible for the return to power of many of Hitler's henchmen and the release of many war criminals, some of whom were released into the service of U.S. intelligence. John J. McCloy also served as a key member of the Warren Commission that covered up the assassination of President Kennedy. Eric M. Warburg is a member of the very powerful Warburg banking family, a transatlantic banking family with branches in Germany, the United Kingdom, and the United States. The Warburgs deeply involved with the capitalization of the IG Farben, German and later Nazi chemical cartel. Henry Kissinger, of course, deeply involved not only with the Rockefeller milieu, but also with the Project Paperclip. He worked for General Bowling on Project Paperclip. Henry Kissinger also deeply involved with the rehabilitation of Nazi war criminals and their inclusion in not only the German national security establishments, but our own as well. So again, when we see John P. Schmitz on the board of directors of the American Council for Germany, that is something that we can use as an advisory in this case. We're going to be taking a much longer career look at the career of John P. Schmitz right now. And again, note his assistance of the elder George Bush as deputy counsel to C. Boyd and Gray when the elder George Bush was not only vice president but president. Note the at least tangential involvement of John P. Schmitz in the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate affairs. What we're going to look at now is some information from the website of Tom Flocco. He spells his last name F-L-O-C-C-O. An excellent website, by the way, has a lot of good information. Research credit on this, as with all of the information on the broadcast, to a member of the listening audience, and a big tip of the hat to that member of the listening audience. Now, this article is called Conflict of Interest, and it deals with a conflict of interest, surprise, surprise, between people involved with the Keene Commission investigating the the 9/11 catastrophe, and investigate for here perhaps belongs to a certain extent in quotes. So there's been some investigating, but there has been some covering up. What Tom Flocco notes here is the conflict of interest between Richard Benveniste and some of the affairs being investigated by the Keene Commission. Benveniste is a counsel with a German international law firm, Mayer, Brown, Rowe, and Maw, and we're going to take a look at some of the cases that that firm is representing. This does indeed create a conflict of interest between those who are ostensibly investigating 9/11 and those who would appear to have a vested interest in covering it up, in this case because some of their clients are implicated in some of the foul doings. Now, we note Mayer, Brown, Rowe, and Maw because one of the counsels with that firm is John P. Schmitz. Tom Flocco's conflict of interest reads as follows. We were shocked to observe how tough and somewhat persistent Richard Benveniste was during his opportunities for questioning. This is the same Richard Benveniste, a former Watergate prosecutor who is a partner in the German international law firm Mayer, Brown, Rowe, and Maw, which happens to be the lead firm representing United Airlines against 9/11 victim families in the New York City litigation in Judge Alvin K. Hellerstein's District Court in Manhattan. This famous lawyer even represented the most recognized American drug dealer in the history of the United States, Barry Seal of Mena, Arkansas fame. Parenthetically, Barry Seal appears to have been deeply involved in some of the Iran-Contra business himself. But interestingly, Benveniste won our award as the most tenacious interrogator on both days, even though the lines of questioning were not consistently intense or pressing on a continual basis. Curiously, no one has questioned whether Mayor Brown's partners would have water cooler and whisper access, unquote, to all the subpoenaed discovery requests and information flow regarding both the Keene Commission's hearings and depositions, public and private, but also Judge Hellerstein's New York City litigation. But that's not the half of it, for the Mayor Brown law firm has another partner named John P. Schmitz, who was the 12-year deputy counsel to George H.W. Bush during his vice presidency and presidency, thus affording the White House a behind-the-scenes source for information flow, discovery, subpoenas, and evidence access regarding both the commission and the New York litigation. Additionally, Mayor Brown also has clients that include Bayer AG, German maker of the antibiotic Cipro, which fights anthrax, about which Larry Klayman and Judicial Watch will have keen interest. By the way, I would note that, of course, Bayer was one of the key elements of the old IG Farben and Nazi chemical cartel. It became a primary element of the post-war Bormann organization, the economic and political branch of the underground Reich. I would also note that in For the Record program 411, called The Bayer Facts, we took a look at the fact that the anthrax attacks, which made Cipro very much in demand, significantly raised the stock of Bayer's pharmaceuticals division, which Bayer was contemplating selling. However, its stock had plummeted in the summer of 2001 due to a blood pressure medicine which Bayer had marketed, which caused a number of deaths. However, because of the anthrax attacks and the Cipro, the consequent demand for Cipro, Bayer's stock then rose above the level that it had been at before the information about the high blood pressure medicine broke, depressing its stock. But note here that John P. Schmitz and Mayor Brown represent Bayer AG, the German maker of the antibiotic Cipro, and note that Larry Klayman and Judicial Watch have filed suit in connection with that. More about that suit, and Judicial Watch is a conservative legal activist group. Judicial Watch has filed suit seeking the administration's anthrax documents to ascertain why the White House started taking heavy doses of Cipro on the day of the attacks, nearly a month before anthrax was even discovered on Capitol Hill, and while postal workers continued to sort mail in contaminated offices, some dying in the process. John Schmitz's Mayor Brown profile also reveals that he represented Enron, adding that, quote, "We were active in Germany with Enron until the end. Its bankruptcy surprised me as well as anyone else," unquote, according to Reuters 1-4-2002. Moreover, Mayor Brown also represents Deutsche Bank on a regular basis regarding its electronic commerce activities, and, curiously, Schmitz's law firm maintains an office in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, along with Enron, if only to make sure oil is well in the Caspian Sea basin. And Deutsche Bank is knee-deep in pre-9/11 insider trading stock profits. Enough said. That is some of the overview on some of the clients of Mayor Brown. Note also that Deutsche Bank is also deeply involved with the Bormann organization. It was apparently involved in some of the stock manipulation in the run-up to September 11th. We've talked about that in For the Record program number 327. We came back to it in 357, and we also talked about it in the aforementioned broadcast, For the Record 411, The Bayer Facts. And so note again some of the clients here of Mayor Brown, and note in particular here, again, the fact that John Schmitz was deeply involved in, is a counsel with this law firm. Note again some of the areas of conflict of interest here for Mayor Brown, Rowe, and Maugh. It's representing United Airlines in a suit brought against that firm by victim families in the New York City litigation, and that is in Judge Alvin K. Hellerstein's district court. It also is representing the Bayer Company, and there's a lawsuit there, and one wonders, of course, about the fact that Richard Ben Benveniste as a partner in this firm, as is John P. Schmitz, and also that Richard Benveniste is on the Keene Commission, as noted here by Tom Flacco in his conflict of interest. This may afford Mayor Brown water cooler and whisper access to some of the subpoenaed discovery requests in this particular case. We're going to take a look now at the curriculum vitae of John P. Schmitz. This is from the Global Project Finance Practice Group from the website of Mayer, Brown, Rowe, and Maw. And the curriculum vitae of John P. Schmitz, a partner in this, is listed as follows. Experience: international antitrust, telecom, energy, and environmental. Leading U.S. and German political regulatory specialist, represents U.S. and European companies on complex international transactions and regulatory matters. Clients include the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Deutsche Welle, German TV, by the way, strongly closely affiliated with the German government, and also with strong connections to the German intelligence service. More clients, General Electric, Bayer AG, that we've also spoken about, Bertelsmann, Bosch GmbH, Gillette and Pfizer, co-chairman of the Federalism Initiative of the U.S. Chamber of Congress seeking legal reform in the United States, global trade and regulatory consulting on behalf of U.S. energy clients in Germany, played a leading role in international agreements such as the 1996 U.S.-German Open Skies Aviation Agreement, and the 1997 U.S.-EU Heavy Electrical Equipment Procurement Dispute and Agreement, resulting in the reform of the German Procurement Code. We're going to talk more about the curriculum vitae of John P. Schmitz here in just a minute. Note that among his clients are the Bertelsmann firm. We've talked about Bertelsmann at great length in the series about German corporate control over the American media. Bertelsmann is a very interesting company. It's one of the largest media companies in the world. It has effective control over English language publishing. Just Bertelsmann's Random House acquisition alone has more than doubled the sales volume of any other English language publisher. Bertelsmann was the publisher for the SS in World War II. Its patron, Heinrich Mohn, the father of Reinhard Mohn, was a member of the SS. People may say, well, that's a long time ago. Dirk Bavendam, the official house historian for Bertelsmann, has published a number of books. The last, republished in 1998. Those books, including the 1998 publication, Roosevelt's Weg zum Krieg, Roosevelt's Way to War, blame World War II on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, U.S. imperialism, and Jewish control over the American media, Hollywood in particular. That is a very, very interesting interpretation of World War II. Again, this comes from the official house historian for Bertelsmann, which dominates English language publishing, and Bertelsmann was the publisher for the SS. And its house historian has published books blaming World War II on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, U.S. imperialism, and Jewish control over the American media. In other words, the standard Nazi line. Bear in mind what I've been talking about in connection with the German corporate control over the American media, and the fact that the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk, published by National Vanguard Books, the publisher of the Turner Diaries, basically forecast that eventual underground Reich control of the world would be achieved in the mid-21st century after the U.S. is destroyed by a series of terrorist incidents involving weapons of mass destruction, at which point the SS, which has gone underground, gained effective control of the opinion-forming media in the United States, then takes over after infiltrating the U.S. Army. Note also that John Schmitz has been involved with global trade and regulatory consulting on behalf of U.S. energy clients in Germany, has helped to with some of the deregulation that has spawned the or led further impetus to the globalization movement. I would also note that U.S. trade representative, the key to U.S. trade representative, is Robert Zoellick, who was involved in the American end of the negotiations for the reunification of Germany. The German end of those was handled by Gunter Strassmeier, whose son Andreas Strassmeier was allegedly the mastermind of the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, and whose protege, Timothy McVeigh, allegedly was. Note that Andreas Strassmeier is represented by Kirk Lyons, one of the top Aryan Nations attorneys in the United States. Now, more about the employment history of Mayor Brown Rowe and Ma's partner, John P. Schmitz, the son of John B. Schmitz. Employment. Mayor Brown and Rowe and Ma, LLP, Washington, D.C., partner, 1993 to date. This, by the way, was after he was the deputy counsel to the elder George Bush from 1984 to 1993, and the elder George Bush's links to not only the Underground Reich, but to a great many other things, including the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate affairs, in which John P. Schmitz appears to have been at least tangentially involved, we've spoken about in the past. More about the employment of John P. Schmitz. Deputy counsel to President George Bush, the White House, Washington, D.C., 1989 to 1993. Deputy Counsel to Vice President George Bush, Office of the Vice President, the White House, Washington, D.C., 1985 to 1989. Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, Washington, D.C., 1984 to 1985. By the way, in the aforementioned series about German corporate control over the American media, we noted that Wilmer Cutler and Pickering was handling the negotiations in the United States on behalf of Deutsche Telekom, which was lobbying to effect major purchases in the American media market. And eventually, one of the first acts of the Bush administration, that's Bush 2, by the way, was to make it legal for foreign media companies that were effectively controlled by foreign governments to purchase major American media. Deutsche Telekom is. I would also note that one of the people who became a partner with Wilmer Cutler and Pickering was a fellow named Matthias Wismann. Matthias Wismann was a former German government official who was a former treasurer for the CDU, and as such was involved with the CDU funding scandal, a very complex arrangement which goes back to, among other things, surprise, surprise, the Underground Reich. So note that Matthias Wismann had become a partner with Wilmer Cutler and Pickering. More about John P. Schmitz's employment history. Robert Bosch Foundation Fellowship, Office of the Bundestag. Member, Matthias Wismann Bonn and Office of General Counsel, Robert Bosch, GmbH, Stuttgart, Germany. So note that John Schmitz had worked for the aforementioned Matthias Wismann, who became a partner for Wilmer Cutler and Pickering when it was representing Deutsche Telekom in its successful effort to effect purchase of American media outlets, and that was a radical departure from previous American law. More about his history. Law clerk to the Honorable Antonin Scalia, U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C. And there are a number of other interesting aspects to his curriculum vitae, but they are not as interesting as what we've spoken about here. So, again, I would note that this fellow, John P. Schmitz, has a very, very interesting history indeed. Note the profound links between the dealings of John P. Schmitz and institutions connected with what I call the Underground Reich. What I'm going to do for the remainder of the broadcast is to just chat a little bit about the concept of the Underground Reich. I can appreciate that when people hear me talking about the Underground Reich, it could lead them to think I have a D blank 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 growing out of my head. A few pieces of information about the Underground Reich. In the first place, one of the reference points that I would give people is the concept of the Mafia. people can accept the fact that the mafia has been able to perpetuate itself for generations in a very effective, clandestine, and when need be, deadly fashion, well, such things can be done. I would refer people to, among other sources, the Encyclopedia Britannica. Look up mafia, and you will find that the mafia began as an underground resistance movement in Sicily in the 12th and 13th centuries to occupation by Norse and later Saracen invaders, basically, Viking and later Arab invaders. Well, the Vikings and the Saracens are long gone from Sicily, where they were in the 12th and 13th centuries, but the resistance movement that grew up in connection with that occupation is very much present in Sicily today. And it's not just present in Sicily, it's present here. Sunday nights, many people watch a TV program on HBO called The Sopranos. It's one of the most popular TV shows in America, and it's about the mafia, which began in the 12th and 13th centuries in Sicily as a resistance movement to the Viking and Saracen occupiers. They're long gone, but the mafia is still there, and it's here, too. The other major reference point that I would give for people to understand, again, the concept of the Underground Reich, is that it is an economic entity, and its realization is inextricably linked with the concept, with the reality of globalization. The major elements involved in globalization I would identify as being in and around the World War I period. First of all, the Webb-Parmalee Act. The Webb-Parmalee Act was a loophole in the U.S. Antitrust Act, which permitted America's robber barons, the high-rolling financiers and industrialists who had established monopolies in the U.S., the trusts, which were outlawed by the Antitrust Act, to do the same thing internationally, basically to establish cartels, international trusts. That and the American industrial boom of World War I, in which America was largely out of the war until 1917, in fact, it was out of the war until 1917, and benefited tremendously from manufacturing weapons for the warring powers of Europe until the U.S. entered the war, and then the U.S. industrial boom of the 1920s gave these robber barons tremendous amounts of capital. Those two things, World War I and 1920s industrial boom and the Webb-Parmalee Act, a loophole in the Antitrust Act, interacted with the Treaty of Versailles, which exacted reparations against German industrialists and financiers, as well against Germany as a whole. Because of the Versailles Treaty, many key German industrialists and financiers began looking abroad to basically establish globalized entities which would enable them to legally escape the reparations payments of the Treaty of Versailles. We've talked about the Thyssen-Bush links in the past. Basically, August Thyssen set up the Bank for Handel and Scheepvaart in Rotterdam, which held the shares for the Thyssen firm. That, in turn, was inextricably linked with the August Thyssen Bank in Berlin and the Union Banking Corporation in New York. It's an early example of how the German industrialists and financiers began seeking to globalize to escape from the Treaty of Versailles. With this tremendous amount of capital generated in the U.S., prowling the globe, looking for partners, they hooked up in a major way with many of their German and also Japanese partners. And that led to the formation of the international cartel system. Basically, it's the Webb-Parmalee Act, the Treaty of Versailles, and the American industrial boom of the late teens and 20s led to globalization in its modern form. And in World War II, the Japanese and Germans used their conquest of Asia and Europe to basically appropriate all of the liquid capital. The Germans were estimated by British intelligence to have looted $180 billion in early 1940s dollars from occupied Europe. By the end of 1943, that doesn't include what they already had looted and from the Soviet Union and Greece, or what they had before, or what they looted afterward. Japan did something very similar. This placed Japan and Germany in a dominant position with regard to the economics of both Asia and Europe, and with the Cold War looming, basically the economic and political results of World War II were snap frozen. The Trilateral Commission, its formation in the United States, the Trilaterals being basically Germany, Japan, and the U.S., was a recognition of the fact that even though the U.S. was the largest economy in the world, with the economic results of World War II having been solidified, Japan and Germany were, along with the U.S., the dominant economic elements on Earth. So in examining the Underground Reich, one should understand that it is a function of globalization, and I've tried to give an overview of that, and remember the mafia paradigm. This concludes side two of For the Record program number 469, The Schmitzes, Republican Family Values, being recorded on July 18th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.